They can stink like fish and rotten eggs, breed swarms of mosquitoes, and lack the glamour of coral reefs. But mangroves, with other coastal habitats, are vitally important to our climate, and they're under threat. In just the past decade, scientists have discovered that these underappreciated coastal habitats, called blue carbon ecosystems, play a huge role in tackling CO2 emissions. But human activities such as burning fossil fuels and coastal development have already caused half of them to disappear. To examine the importance of blue carbon ecosystem, I'm speaking to Paul Carnell from the School of Life and Environment Science at Deakin University. Welcome, Paul.
Great, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Blue carbon coastal ecosystem are generally off the radar in the climate change debate. Could you describe the sorts of environments that which are examples of those ecosystems?
Yeah, so probably the main three that we're really focusing on are seagrasses, mangroves, and salt marsh, or tidal marsh is another name for them. And so, yeah, I guess kind of like your introduction said, you know, some of these mangroves and salt marsh areas, you know, they're kind of tricky for us to be in. They can smell. So, yeah, they kind of have been a little bit underappreciated. But what we're realizing is that they're actually doing a lot more to help capture carbon dioxide emissions than that really big tree next door that we've, I guess, traditionally thought of in the carbon offsetting space.
Now, what sort of unique properties differentiate blue carbon coastal ecosystem from land-based systems?
Yeah, well, probably one of the reasons they went really unnoticed is that, so unlike in the forest, most of the carbon that they're capturing is in the trees themselves. So you see these big trees, and they're converting that CO2 into that plant biomass, into that tree, and that's the carbon storage. Whereas in these systems, more than 50% of the carbon being stored is actually being stored in the ground. And what they're doing is each year they're adding another layer of new sediment and plant material into the ground. And then it doesn't decompose. It kind of gets trapped in there, and it traps all of that carbon dioxide in the ground with it. And they continually do that every year. So I guess they partly went unnoticed because they were locking it away where we couldn't really see that easily.
So that might explain that sort of black mud around mangroves.
yeah, that's right. What most people would think of smelly, muddy, that's actually kind of the liquid gold, so to speak. And these days, now working on mangroves in these systems, I have this new appreciation for mud. And I get really excited when we take a sediment core out of these systems. So we take a bit of PVC tube and we hammer that into the ground. We bring the sediment up and we can look at it and see how much carbon is there. And, yeah, we get really excited when we're looking at mud.
So how far down does these deposits go? Is it just a surface thing about, you know, metre and a half, or does it go deeper?
Yeah, so some places it can be, like several metres to tens of metres. So, it mostly just depends on how long those systems have been around in that area. So each year they're probably adding a couple of millimetres worth of new sediment in. So, yeah, I guess if you times that over, 50 years, 100 years, or hundreds of years, thousands of years, then that's how, you get this build-up of these deposits over time. But also kind of like what your introduction said, they're building up continually over the years, and, so over a metre's worth of soil, you might have, like 50 to 100 years worth of soil accumulation. But those areas can also then be vulnerable if there's disturbance to those areas. And so we can find that maybe what took 50 or 100 years to accumulate could actually be released back into the environment in a very short time span, whether it be from channel dredging, from the kind of like housing development side of things, or for grazing. We can actually see the release of that carbon that was stored back up into the atmosphere. So actually, when you disturb them, then they become an emission. So they're kind of a double-edged sword. They're obviously these great habitats, great for doing it, But if we disturb them, if we're not looking after them, then they can start releasing that, that carbon dioxide.
Now, you're talking about taking core samples and all that, and what we're talking about here is carbon sequestration. Do you actually do things like carbon date those cores to sort of find out how long they've been sitting there?
So that's one of the main ways that we can figure out how quickly that carbon's been accumulating is, yeah, we take those core samples and then we get dates on the soil at the different depths. And, yeah, we line those all up and say over the last 50 years, 100 years, it's been storing, you know, say 5 tonnes of carbon dioxide per hectare per year or something along those lines. So, yeah, we use that core dating to be able to measure that.
One thing I'd like to address is the difference between these ecosystems and comparing it with the on-land systems, that is, you know, trees, tropical forests, etc., and comparing the relative rate and intensity of capturing carbon.
Yeah, so there's been some really great work being done now that we're suddenly learning more about these systems of, yeah, then comparing them. And so, yeah, if you're, say, comparing a fully grown forest, so, you know, it's really pristine, it's in good condition. Because they're already fully grown, they're actually not storing that much extra per year. But whereas when we compare them to these blue carbon ecosystems, they can be storing 20 up to even 40 times the amount each year. And that's because they're continually adding that new sediment into the ground. And so that's why we end up with these really high numbers, is because when we've got these fully established systems, the blue carbon areas are continually adding that sediment into the ground. And so, yeah, we end up with a number that's somewhere between 20 to 40 times the rate of carbon sequestration. And that's per hectare per year. So you obviously then have to take into account the area that these places are covering. But, they're pretty staggering numbers. And I think that's what kind of really caught the attention of both the Australian government but also governments globally in thinking about how we can include these systems into greenhouse gas budgets for the different countries but also into the carbon offsetting scheme as well. So before, you know, you might be able to plant a tree or pay a certain amount of money that plants a tree to offset your flights or your car. So I guess the work we're trying to do is say, well, you can maybe actually pay to offset, but that'll be planting a mangrove or restoring some seagrass instead to offset carbon emissions.
Now, I might be totally wrong here, but I this is a sort of putting my hand up, asking the teacher question.
Yeah.
I seem to remember that in the case of something like sea level rise, it doesn't actually destroy mangroves. They sort of migrate backwards into the land. Is that the case?
It's going to be a really interesting time for them into the future. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work being done on how sea level rise is going to affect them. In some places, if there's the room for them to move back, that would be their natural response. So if there's no concrete walls or if there's no houses in the way, then, yeah, their natural response is that over the time, because sea level rise will take a little while, they'll just naturally move back. I guess where the problem will be is if they're moving back, but then they're confronting the human structures that aren't allowing them to go any further. And the term they use for this is coastal squeeze. So you can imagine, you know, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, and they'll slowly be squeezed out between this kind of rising sea level and some of these human structures. There are some areas where actually the mangroves, because they accrete this sediment every year, they may actually be able to keep pace with sea level rise and almost build a natural wall. So if we think of that, you know, couple of millimetres of sediment they're adding each year, if they can do that consistently, then there's some work that shows that some places they might be able to keep pace. So, yeah, that's a really interesting area of research at the moment, is figuring out what are the areas that are vulnerable to sea level rise, and we might have to help those systems out a bit, or what areas will they actually be a great natural defence against sea level rise, actually maybe protecting a bunch of human infrastructure behind. So it's a very interesting space at the moment.
Blue carbon ecosystems are very good at absorbing carbon. You turn that around, what's the problem if those systems are compromised? What's the rate of release of carbon from those systems once they've been compromised? Is it sort of slow, fast, whatever?
Yeah, so I guess it kind of depends on what it's caused them to be lost, I guess. So if it's something like seagrass, then it could be, you know, if it's something like, say, dredging of the sediment, then that will actually lead to quite a lot of loss of that carbon because you're dredging it back up, you're exposing it back to oxygen, and then you're going to be having that carbon released back. So when we talk about these really big numbers of how much carbon is being stored in those systems, then a lot of that could actually be converted back into carbon dioxide. In other areas, whether, say maybe it's farming or something, that might really influence the top 50 centimetres or so. We're still kind of figuring out exactly how much, but yeah, I guess depending on what the disturbance is, it could either release a lot or maybe a smaller fraction. There's other activities, particularly where, not necessarily as much in Australia, but where they might be clearing mangroves to actually start up aquaculture. And so those activities, again, are really destructive and then are releasing a lot of that carbon back into the environment. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressures on the coastline at the moment. And, yeah, particularly in some of the kind of tropical developing nations that are turning to aquaculture as a source of income. Well, some of these mangroves and salt marsh areas, unfortunately for them, are great places to do it. So some of the really big numbers of carbon dioxide released from mangrove loss are actually from areas where the mangroves are being cleared for those purposes. Fortunately, in Australia at least, on the salt marsh and mangrove side of things, these days we're doing a much better job of at least protecting what's there. But yeah, obviously in the past there was loss of a fair amount of salt marsh and mangroves in areas that we decided we wanted to live or to farm. So yeah, I guess we can't quite take that back. but I guess that's where we can look at restoring these ecosystems. So thinking about, well, if this area is maybe going to go under with sea level rise anyway, maybe we should allow this area to go back to mangroves and salt marsh. That will store a lot of carbon, but maybe they also might help protect our coastlines as well. I guess we're really also starting to look at, yeah, what are all these other co-benefits? So we know they're great for storing carbon, and we can kind of tick that box. We've touched briefly on the kind of sea level rise, coastal defence side of things, but they're also nursery grounds for fish we like to catch and eat, whether it be recreationally or commercially. So by keeping these habitats in good health, yeah, there's all these other great things that they're doing for us as well.